like a small child, afraid to look, yet afraid to look away. It was hard to see because my eyelids were trying to freeze shut. My fingers no longer moved individually, so I rubbed the butt of my hand across my eyes and blinked to clear my sight. The swirling was right in front of my face now, and it carried the rhythm of many. The patterns swooped in close to the ground and then snapped back quickly as if teasing the ground to follow. I reached my hand out to touch one of the strands, but it slipped through my fingers with the snowflakes. I reached out farther, but every time I got close, the white tendrils whirled away. I placed my arm under me, pushed myself up on one elbow, and looked through my tunnel of snow-coated cloth. They were small, cone-shaped bells that chimed lightly as they moved in tiny rows across well-rounded cloth, which draped from opulent forms. The bells continued to ring even when the wind fringe swept them away. I pulled myself over to one side of the walking trench and sat there for a moment, listening to the voices, to the bells as they ascended into the treetops. These voices were in a higher register than the ones that had accompanied me on my way down, and they comforted and stimulated at the same time. I pulled the makeshift hood back and felt my head loll sideways under my left shoulder. The long, fringed fingers traced fire trails across the length of my shoulders, but when I turned, they snapped into the retreating snow. I felt another set cross the small of my back, but when I straightened, they too continued up the trail. I pulled a leg under me, toppled into a crouch, and then stood. It was difficult to walk at first, but the rhythm of the tiny bells and the way the tassels and cloth stretched across languid muscles drew me forward. Voices were speaking into my exposed ear, whispering in tongues that I didn't understand. I could never hear the beginnings or the ends of the sentences, only the smoldering playfulness that fueled them. The words simultaneously tickled and burned. Some were lugubrious and extended, others were short and sharp, like surprised snatches of breath. I listened to the words and the melody and staggered upward, the hillside rising to meet my feet as they sank into the receptive snow. It was much deeper now, and the wind flattened the hanging cloth of the seat cover to the back of my legs and froze it there, pulling at the top of my head whenever a hind step lingered an instant too long. I didn't pay any attention to the path any longer. I just followed the tinkling silver bells and the swirling deerskin as they continued in their circular pattern up the hill. Their mouths didn't smile, but their eyes did. The same glittering obsidian as before, but with a great deal more promise, with promises of everything under arched eyebrows and thick lashes. The ground grew flatter for a while and then steepened in the opposite direction as my heels began striking the muffling snow before my toes. The momentum carried me forward, and I only slowed as the other voices joined in, the voices from before. They provided a strong bass counterpoint to the ascension of the bells and harmonized with the wavering beauty of the voices that had gone before me up the hill. Then, on the path ahead, I could see them standing in a group, looking down at something on the ground. They all smiled, the close-mouthed smile, and looked back to me. I trudged on and stood there among them, looking around and smiling too. But there was something at the middle of the group, something that didn't move, and I rested my chin on my chest to look at it. It was large and it looked heavy, but they seemed to prize it in some way, so I leaned down and brushed some of the snow away. When I finished brushing the majority of the snow off it, I stood back with the others and listened to a new song, one that sounded much closer, with words that I remembered. I could hear all of this song, the beginning, middle, and end. It was a very forceful melody, and it was coming from a thing in the path. We listened to it for a while, all of us smiling, and then they began breaking away. But before each one of them began their swirling and swooping and snapping, they motioned for me to take the thing in the trail as a gift. I stepped back as they offered it to me. Two of them each took one of my hands and placed them on the object before us. It sang louder as I touched it, and I reached around and pulled it from the ground as the remaining snow sloughed off. It was heavy and cumbersome to carry, but it seemed ungracious not to take it. Its song became strained as I loaded it onto my back. The snow seemed to part as I moved forward in time with the bodies in the shadows to my left and right. There were small flashes in the darkness ahead, as if they were clearing a path for me, muted flashes of crimson and cobalt within the smothering white. My legs began to shake with the weight of the gift, but dropping it in the face of such hospitality would be unendurable, so I kept walking. Soon the flat gave way to a gentle, downward slope, and the images tilted the world in my favor, allowing me longer strides and easier breathing through the cotton cloth that was now frozen to my face. I didn't feel the cold anymore, and noticed a jaunty quality accompanied my step as I matched it with the music of the small jingle bells and with the pace of the darting figures all around me. The best part of the song emanated from the gift I carried. It caught all the complex rhythms and melodies of the group and conveyed it in a singular fashion so that it was easier to understand. Its voice was right behind my head, and its strength reverberated through me and into the ground with each step. But after a while, the song changed and became more maudlin and extended. I shook the weight on my back to get it to switch back to the melody from before, but that didn't work. It was harder to get my stride back with the new song, since the patterns were not even and my steps wouldn't match. I was beginning to wonder what was so great about the gift they had given me when I passed the spot where I had taken the little nap on the way up. I was thinking about taking another one, but others had joined in with the song on my back, and the whole thing took on the feeling of a processional. I didn't want to be the first to break step, so I just kept going. After a while, I became aware of a large shape up and off to my right. I remembered it as being something important, but I couldn't remember why or what it was. There was a sharper drop-off as I made my way around that shape, and I almost lost my footing as I skirted it. I had a vague recollection of it having hurt me in the past, but it seemed benign enough now. I stood at a flat spot and struggled to stay upright. I remembered that there was something waiting for me just a little ways ahead, so I started off once more, but the voices lingered in the shadows behind me. They had elected to stay in the forest, and I would have turned to look back at them, but it would have taken more energy than I had. I felt bad about not saying goodbye. The song on my back continued, although the quality of its tone had weakened. I had to get where I was going before the song on my back stopped. I wasn't sure how I knew this, but I did. I started forward again, and as I came across an area where the snow was shallower, I remembered a promise that had been made to me. It was something important, too. It was a promise about leaving. All the important promises are about leaving or not leaving. I thought about turning around to see what it was that I was leaving, but if you did that enough, you didn't leave. And then, what were all the promises about? I kept walking. I could barely hear the song on my back now, so I shook it to try and get it going. It stopped. I shook it some more, trying to get it going again, but it still wouldn't start. I thought about dropping it since it didn't work anymore, but they might be watching from the trees. I guess they figured I needed some help because the flashes were back, crimson and cobalt flares that lit up the snow in a rhythm of their own, but the spirits must have been getting tired too because the lights seemed to have lost their individuality and were blinking in a monotonous and irritating fashion. The music was gone. The bells and the drums and the voices had drifted off with the wind. I listened, but there was only an ugly squawking. I shook the song on my back, but it remained obstinate. I figured it was probably the cold, that some part of it must have frozen. I would have to see if I could fix it once I got to where I was going. I tried to remember where it was I was going, but all I could think of was that it was warmer there. I was about ready to set the song down and take a rest, but the shadows were there again. Some of them stepped out from the snow clouds to my right, and I was just starting to see the ones to my left when I noticed that, unlike the others, they were coming straight at me. The only thing I could figure was that they wanted the song back. Indian givers. I stopped and stood up straight. I was a lot bigger than they were, now that we were on level ground. They stopped as well, but their arms reached out to the song. I whirled around a half step to let them know that they couldn't have it. I tried to speak, but it was as if my vocal cords were frozen, so I just roared and took a few quick breaths to get ready for the fight. The smallest one was directly ahead of me. It was the one that had backed off the least. I focused on that shadow, and leaned in to smash it. It still didn't move, but just stood there, hips shot and kind of crooked, like most of its weight was resting on one side with a hand on its hip. You had to be careful, because the little ones might be just as powerful as the big ones. It didn't really matter how big they were, or how many of them there were, though. I wasn't giving up the song. The little one still didn't move, and I was just getting ready to crush it, when it spoke in a sharp and unpleasant, yet strangely familiar voice, "Nice fucking outfit." Later, when I rolled my head over and found Henry looking at me through barely open eyes, as the EMT van slowly made its way through the drifts that had accumulated throughout the evening and on into the night, I asked him if he thought it had been wise to be singing all that time with the internal injuries he'd sustained. Groggily, all he said was, "Worth singing." Chapter 13. "What do you mean you released yourself on your own recognizance?" I rang the bell a bunch of times, but nobody came around. I was trying to look reputable, but it was difficult with the clothes I was wearing.
"So you just left?"
We stood there for a moment, looking at each other.
"They're on the phone, and they want to know where you are."
Ruby had a point, and in hindsight, it did seem a little irresponsible. I straightened some of my papers and tried to look busy. "Well, tell them I'm here."
"You tell them. Explain to the doctor why it is he can't find you anywhere in his hospital."
I stared down at the blinking red light. I had to get a different color. It was still early, and the sky was getting a little bruised yellow to the east. The tail end of the storm was tapering off to the Powder River country, but the sky still stayed mostly gray. They said it was over, but I felt like it might be stalking me. I remained there for a while, not allowing the pain in my fingers and ear to get the best of me. I could hear Lucian chuckling to himself in the hallway. Changing of the guard. I had timed it poorly. If I had arrived earlier, I could have gotten things going and hit the road before Ruby had shown up for duty. I woke up very early and couldn't get back to sleep, so I lay there and thought about Henry. I rang the little bell for the night nurse and waited about 5 minutes, then I rang it again and again. A half an hour went by, and I decided to go look for the bear myself. The IVs were the biggest pain in the ass, but they came out pretty easily, and the tape covered the holes so that the bleeding stopped. I had dismissed the idea of dragging them along with me, as they would cut down on this particular mission's stealthy quality. The nurse had hidden my personal belongings, but I found them in a locker near her station, which was, I had learned, the safest place to avoid her. There was a little cardboard sign on the desk that said, "In case of emergency, continue to the clinic or ring bell." I'm cagey that way, so I didn't ring the bell or go to the clinic. There was a guy who might have been part crow mopping the hallway when I came back to my room to change into my clothes. He had the sickly look that everybody adopts after working nights for a while. I had had that look before. "How you doing?" He stared at my gown and the clothes I clutched to my chest, but didn't say anything. He leaned on his mop and stared at me some more. "You know where they stuck Henry Standing Bear?" He motioned the mop handle toward the room across from mine, 62. We stood there for a moment longer. "Thanks." He continued mopping, and I ducked into my room to get dressed. My hands were swollen and starting to blister, and it was only with a great deal of difficulty that I snapped my shirt. The rubber boots were the hardest part, so I finally left them unlaced. My hat hadn't been with the rest, and I paused for a moment to think about when I'd seen it last. I thought it was on the mountain, but I couldn't be sure. I fingered the glob of tape attached to the side of my head and felt the tenderness that must have been my ear. It hurt worse than anything else, but at least they hadn't cut it off. By the time I opened the door and looked around, the guy with the mop had moved on to another hallway or had gone to fetch the elusive nurse. I quickly moved across the hall and into the room opposite, hoping it was the right one. I stood there in the dark, letting my eyes adjust. It was a mirror image of mine, with the exception that it did not look out on the parking lot. The breathing was heavy, regular, and familiar. I moved carefully to the bed and looked down. He seemed to be all there, and short of pulling down the sheet and examining the wound myself, I would have to go on the assumption that he was doing all right. He had a couple of IVs stuck in him, too, but there weren't any monitors attached, and that gave me hope. I looked around for a clipboard at the foot of his bed that would tell me how he was, but there wasn't one. Durant Memorial Hospital was doing little to live up to the expectations I had developed as a teenager watching Ben Casey. I wasn't sure what else to do, and I wasn't certain why I was here, other than to just make sure he was alive and well. They lie a lot in hospitals. It's their job to supersede the power of the Almighty with half-truths. Better to check things out for yourself. I was about halfway to the door when he spoke.
Thank you for the visit.
I stopped and crept back. I left the Whitman sampler on the nightstand.
Very thoughtful.
I took a breath. How do you feel?
Doped.
Must be nice. All I got was some Tylenol. He rolled his head toward me a little, looking at my clothes.
Where are you going?
To look for George Esper.
You want to kill him before somebody else does?
I continued to look at him.
You aren't that doped up. I was just thinking of calling and asking for some more.
Good luck. I patted his arm and started to back toward the door. Get some rest.
Walt?
I stopped.
Thanks.
When I got into the hallway, there was still nobody there, so I quickly made my way around the corner. To my utter surprise, a nurse sat at the nurse's station. She was looking at me, so I marched straight over to her, crossed my arms, leaned on the chest-high partition, and draped my hands by my side where she couldn't see them. There was nothing I could do about the ear.
Hi. I was just checking on a patient here, Henry Standing Bear. You've got him in room 62.
She had sandy hair, china blue eyes, and looked like she was about 14.
Yes?
He was complaining about some pain, and I was wondering if somebody could get him more medication. She seemed a little distracted as she picked up a phone.
Certainly.
She looked at me a little more closely.
Aren't you in room 61, Uncle Walter?
I glanced around as if it were obvious.
No, I'm not.
I looked at her more carefully.
Do I know you?
I'm Janine Reynolds. I'm Ruby's granddaughter.
The eyes started to look more familiar, so I smiled.
How are you doing, Janine?
She didn't smile back.
What are you doing out of room 61?
I thought for a moment.
Official business.
The brat. She'd called her grandmother and told her everything, especially the part where I didn't know her from Adam. Maybe they had given me more than Tylenol. At least, that's what I told Ruby. I sat at my desk and watched as Lucian ambled in on his man-made leg and occupied the chair opposite mine. He was studying me with more scrutiny than I was comfortable with.
What? I bet you they'd take that ear.
I sighed. Just because they're always taking parts off of you.
That's what they do best, take parts off.
I'm pretty fond of this ear. He scratched his stump.
Yeah, well, I was pretty damn fond of my leg.
I waited. Anybody got any idea where George might have gone? He leaned back in the chair, hands spread onto his thighs with the fingers stretched.
Got an APB out, but then HPs are about as useless as tits on a boar hog.
How did he get out before Vic and Ferg got in? He shrugged.
Must have left right after you left him, in that little Jap piece of crap.
His head leaned to one side, and he was the perfect picture of disgruntled as he gazed at the floor.
Little shitbird.
He looked back up.
Stop playing with your ear.
I had been.
You're going to do more damage playing with it than you did freezing it.
I decided to change the subject.
Where is everybody? Turk's still out at the Esper place. Guess he's trying to work his way back into your good graces. Ferg was running some food out to him, but that was an hour ago.
He grunted.
Ferg's got your hat.
I was wondering where it had gone off to.
You're going to need it to hide that half ear you're going to have.
I sighed some more.
Vic, up at the DCI compound.
He said it with the same derisive conviction he had for the highway patrol. He looked out the window at the frozen sky.
What did the little pissant get shot with?
I felt around in the jacket I still had on and tossed the gun onto the desk with a satisfying clatter. I was showing Lucian that I could be tough, too. Next thing you knew, we'd be breaking out the bourbon and calling Ruby a twist. Then the real fun would start. He looked at the little revolver. That ought to do it. His eyes came up to mine. How bad? Not bad enough to keep him from jumping in the driver's seat and leaving us in the lurch. I leaned forward on the desk and told Lucian about the Vasks, size 9s, and about the conversation I had had with George before I had gone back for Henry. He neither responded nor remarked until I was through, just sat there looking at me. I was remembering what a good lawman he was when he finally spoke. Well, he's got to get doctored somewhere. He cleared his throat. Seems to me you just left the place where you should have started looking for him. You don't think he's stupid enough to go to the hospital? He was stupid enough to be up there fishing in a blizzard. Stupid enough to try and shoot you and ladies where. Stupid enough to try and make a run for it. He stopped, shook his head, and folded his arms over his chest to signify the particular gaps in my line of thinking. I'd say the depths of his stupidity have yet to be plumbed, and yours is coming up fast on the inside turn. I had gotten a lot of tirades like this when I was a deputy under Lucian, but I didn't take them personally, much. So we've got the hospitals and doctor's offices, but they have to report any kind of gunshot wounds. You couldn't get him to answer a bell. How long you think it'll take him to file a report? He had a point. You want to take a ride? I'm saddled, and if you're waiting for me, you're backing up. It was like working with Louis L'Amour. Ruby stopped me as we tried to make our way out of the office. Do you think you should make an attempt at cleaning up? I looked down at the stains and rumples that made up today's and yesterday's ensemble. Let the citizens know they're getting their money's worth. You have dried blood all down your back. I dodged out the door before she could say anything else, with Lucian cadging along after me. I gave the old sheriff a hand as he pulled himself up into the truck. He took out his pipe and a small beaded leather pouch of tobacco and began filling the cherry wood bowl. I noticed the pattern on the small bag and recognized it as the same as the dead man's body and a Cheyenne rifle. I informed Lucian of this. He looked at the pouch anew as the smoke drifted around his head and his dark eyes and out the window he had just cracked. Well, I'll be damned. Going back to the hospital was risky business, but it was a chance I was going to have to take. Lucian waited patiently. His Isaac Bloomfield looked over my hands and examined my ear while I questioned him about any other gunshot wounds that might have popped up last evening. He said there had been nothing suspicious to report, but that if anything came up, he'd be sure to get a hold of me as quickly as possible. I asked about Henry, but all he did was kind of chuckle and said the nurses were taking very good care of him. I feared for Janine Reynolds's virginity. Much to Lucian's dismay, he, my entire ear, and myself left shortly thereafter. We continued our search to the drugstore downtown, where they reported that they had not sold a single Band-Aid since yesterday afternoon. It was a tough economy on the High Plains. I turned and looked at him as I started the truck. Veterinarians? Taxidermists. I'm not sure why, but it made sense. Which one? He pulled on his pipe and studied the problem. One thing we had no shortage of in Wyoming is taxidermists. How about that outfit of Pat Hampton's down on Swayback Road? I wheeled the bullet into a U-turn and headed south. A few vehicles slowed, and the drivers gave me irritated looks. Lucian shot them the bird, and I slapped his hand down as he snickered and told me to turn on the lights and siren to show them we meant business. I figured he just wanted to run them again, so I did. I navigated the entrance ramp of the highway at the south side, and since there wasn't any snow on the road, took the truck up to about 85. He didn't say anything, just looked ahead, and I figured I was going to hear about it. I was right, but it wasn't what I thought it would be. What you did up there? Yep. That was a hell of a thing. I nodded and looked ahead, too. I didn't tell him about the old Cheyenne.
Pat Hampton's was an odd mixture of taxidermy and game processing. It was said that no matter what you wanted to do with an animal, Pat could assist you. When we pulled up to the ramshackle complex of dilapidated buildings, you could have knocked me over with a feather. Pulled around to the far side of one of the buildings, covered with mud and with the side caved in, was a black Mazda Navajo with the plates tough one. "Banzai!" The old sheriff smiled and pulled the pipe from his mouth as I eased the bullet up to the other side of the building. "You got a gun I can borrow?" I unlocked the 870 Wingmaster from the dash. "This kid is a victim." He looked at the shotgun. "Fugitive from justice. Lucian, do me a favor and don't shoot anybody." He jacked the pump action and fed a shell of double-aught buck into the breech. "Ain't nothing wrong with shooting folks, long as the right ones get shot." The next 5 minutes promised an inordinate variety of excitements. I pulled out my .45 and checked it, like I always did, then reholstered it, snapping the leather strap over the hammer. The old outlaw smiled. "Front or back?" I looked at the accumulation of buildings, trying to figure out which was which. "I'll take the front." The Remington waved in my direction as he navigated the door, and I was acutely aware that he had not put on the safety. I walked across the muddy slush of the lot to what looked like it might be the front as Lucian swung-stepped his way around the corner of the ratty, brown-painted building. There were boot prints leading up to the aluminum screen door that had only some battered strips of screening still attached. There was a plastic sign in the window, fly-specked and bleached by the sun. In swirling letters it read, "Sorry, we're closed." There were ancient blinds in the windows, but there was a small, diamond-shaped pane in the door that was unshaded. I poked my head through the empty frame of the screen and looked through the dirty glass. I could see an odd combination of living room and reception area with sofas, a console television, and some sort of strange reception desk. I noted the hallway leading to the right after you got past the desk and figured that was where I should go once I'd gotten through the door. "Sheriff's Department!" I pounded on the door with the flat of my hand. "George, if you're in there, let's not make things worse." I listened as a shuffling noise came from the center of the building. I took a deep breath and checked the knob. It was locked. I banged on the door again. "Sheriff's Department, I'm coming in!" I took another couple of breaths and unsnapped the strap from the top of my holster. I only had a certain amount of time before Lucian came in the rear, but I figured having only one leg would slow him up in kicking his own door down. I carefully swung back the screen door frame so as not to get caught in it, and pulled the Colt from my holster, clicking the safety off and holding it in the air. I leaned back and put everything into a 14E width. I guess I was expecting a little more resistance from the rotting, hollow-core door, because I followed it rather rapidly as it folded up into two main pieces and blew us into the room and onto the sofa at the opposite wall. I heard a loud thumping at my right and pushed off the couch, cleared the doorway at the hall, and ran toward the noise. When I got to the entryway at the opposite end, somebody was coming the other way but didn't see me until it was too late. I just kept running and carried him back into the room as I led with the point of my unarmed shoulder. I heard the air leave his body as we went back through the doorway, and he felt familiar. "Hello, George." We bounced off a large table at the center and slid to the cool tile surface of the floor. I steadied myself against the countertop with one hand and stood. It was George, all right. And he was out again. He was only partially dressed and still held his pants in his hands. There was a large wrapping of bandages at the middle of his right thigh and another set around his head that was holding his jaw secure. I stood the rest of the way up, pulled out my handcuffs, and secured George to the table. As I finished this, there was noise down the hallway and an explosion that was unmistakable as the sound of a 12-gauge shotgun being discharged filled the air. I started to head down the corridor when another young man with a pale face came bursting through the doorway with what looked like a rifle in his hands. When he saw the barrel of the .45 about a foot from his nose, he pulled up short and froze. "Sheriff's Department, you don't move!" His hands went straight up along with the rifle. "I won't!"
You just did.
He looked confused for a moment. Drop the rifle. He hesitated for a second.
You got a problem?
He was still frozen.
It might go off.
All right, you keep it pointed away from me and set it down on the table.
He did as requested, and I told him to stretch forward and place his hands on the counter, palms down.
He did this, and it seemed like he was going to cry. I had a moment to look at him. He was just about George's age. It all figured.
Lucian, you all right?
There was a little more clatter, and he answered from the distance,
Yes, goddammit!
I went around the corner of the table and looked at the kid's rifle and propped the butt against my hip.
A pellet gun?
His face turned toward mine. It's all I had, and I didn't want to hurt anybody. Lucian appeared in the doorway, shotgun at the ready.
Damn door was locked!
I sat on the edge of the table and stuck the pellet rifle under an arm as I put my sidearm back in the holster and looked at the kid, trying to place him.
Well, where's Pat? He away?
Lucian planted one of his formidable claws at the back of the kid's neck.
Yeah!
I watched as Lucian's grip tightened.
Hey!
His voice strained.
You say sir!
Lucian leaned in over the boy's head.
Yes, sir!
The voice was even more strained.
Yes, sir!
Lucian! He let up a little bit and looked at me questioningly.
Why? I ain't hurting the little pissant.
He rolled his eyes, stepped back to the doorway, and poked the kid with the barrel of the Remington before resting a shoulder against the facing.
Don't you forget that I'm here, son.
Even from my perspective, I could see that the safety was still not on.
He's down in Casper buying a truck.
Are you Petey Hampton, Bruce's boy?
He smiled at being recognized.
Yes, sir.
I thought you were in school down in Colorado.
The smile hung there.
I'm home to hunt for the weekend.
How did George know you were coming up?
I called him last week. He was going to go with me.
I pulled the pellet gun from my underarm and broke the barrel down, used a fingernail to pull the pellet in the tiny gun out, and let the small mushroom-shaped projectile fall to the floor. I tossed the rifle onto a desk filled with taxidermy supplies, which made a tremendous noise.
Okay, Petey, we've got two options here. Number one is me reading you your rights and taking you up to town and booking you on at least resisting arrest and with a criminal conspiracy charge that's going to look really good on your transcript. Or you and I just have a little chat, and we don't tell your school or your daddy and uncle what you've been up to.
It didn't take him long to answer. Maybe the college thing was working out.
What do you want to know?
It was about that time that there was a clamoring at the other end of the table. George Esper must have awakened, heard a little bit of what was being said, and decided once again to make a break for it. The table moved about 6 inches, even with my weight on it, when George reached the end of his stainless steel tether. A low moan emanated from below the other end of the table as Lucian walked around and looked down at him.
"Son, I have met some sorry little bastards in my life. Lucian, don't abuse a prisoner."
He looked up with his mouth pulled to one side.
"Hell, I ain't the one that shot him and broke his jaw."
"He shot himself."
"Yeah, that's your story."
I turned back to Petey, who had not moved, but whose eyes seemed a little wider. "What's the story on Houdini down here?" He looked confused, so I nodded toward the moaning.
"George."
He cleared his throat.
"He called me this morning, real early. He said he had a hunting accident and that he didn't want to go to the hospital because it was going to cost a lot."
I nodded.
"He showed up with his jaw and all. I started thinking that there might be something else going on."
"You doctored him up?"
"Yes, sir."
"He got here when?"
"About an hour ago."
"What all did he have to say?"
Petey looked at the ceiling, and I sighed.
"Petey, I think you are considering lying to me, and I would advise you against it."
"He said he ran his car off the road."
"Anything about his parents?"
"He said they were in Deadwood."
"Well, that answered a few questions."
Outside, I placed George in the passenger seat of the bullet and found his keys in the bunched pants he still had on his lap. I tossed the keys to Lucian.
"What am I supposed to do with these?"
"He drove the thing with one leg. I figure you can, too. Go get Turk out of the Espers. I'm headed to the hospital to get George here looked at."
You ought to kick his skinny little ass. But you do as you see fit.
When I got in, George was looking at the steering column for the keys to my truck. When he caught my eye, he leaned against the door and began moaning, with his eyes partially closed. George, so far your situation is not irretrievable. Henry Standingbear is unlikely to press charges, and I'll do what I can about the mandatories if you tell me everything I want to know. One eye opened a little more. Where are your parents? He started to speak, then put a hand to his mouth in an attempt to still the pain.
Deadwood.
I keyed the mic on my radio. Come in base, this is Unit 1. I waited as Lucian backed the Mazda out and pulled up beside me with a questioning look. I held up the mic to show him what was up. He nodded and headed off for the Espers. The entire side of the little truck was dented from one end to the other. Come in, base.
Static. What do you want now?
Ruby, the Espers are in Deadwood, South Dakota. Can you make the appropriate inquiries?
Static. How did you find that out?
I'm sitting here with the elusive George Esper.
Static. Does he know where they're staying?
I looked over at George, who was now watching me with both eyes.
Lothlar.
Lodestar? He nodded. I keyed the mic. The Lodestar. Any word from up on the mountain?
Static. They're on their way down.
Roger that. I'll be over at the hospital.
Static. 10-4.
I stared at the radio. What did you just say?
Static for a moment, then a sharp response. I wouldn't press my luck if I were you.
I started the truck, wheeled around, and headed back for the highway. The gravel road wasn't too bad, but George moaned with a little more persistence every time the truck bounced. He was back in full victim mode.
Your parents gambling in Deadwood?
I glanced over at him. Just nod your head, yes or no. He nodded yes and looked out the windshield.
Your brother with him?
He shook his head. Was he supposed to meet you fishing up on the mountain? He nodded, then after a second turned to look at me. I looked back at the road and nodded a little myself. We'll talk some more about that at the hospital. His eyes stayed on me, and I was convinced he wasn't the Vasks size nines we were looking for.
He's hurt?
No, he's not hurt. It wasn't a complete lie. We just need to get you repaired. I changed the subject. Sorry about the jaw. He nodded and slouched farther against the door. He really was a mess. I don't think the second altercation had done him much good, and the symptoms of the first were plainly evident. The discoloration from his jaw had spread to his eyes, and the swelling had puffed his face so that he was almost unrecognizable. There was that, and the fact that being confused with his brother wouldn't be an issue anymore. The radio interrupted my thoughts.
Come in, Unit 1.
Static.
I've got the Espers on Line 1. You want me to patch them through?
I glanced over at George, who was studying me very closely. No, just get the number, and I'll call them back in about 5 minutes.
Static. Roger that.
I looked at the radio and smiled. By the time we got to the hospital, it was looking like a cop convention. Both Vic's and Ferg's vehicles were parked in the official spots at the emergency room entrance. I pulled up to the door and walked around to get George. There was a small crowd at the desk when I made my way in.
You know, just because you're as big as a bus doesn't mean you have to provide service like one.
I casually bumped past her and sat George in the wheelchair that Janine had pulled from the wall. He's got a gunshot wound in his left thigh, and I think his jaw's busted. You better check his ribs. Thanks, Janine. She rolled George away, and I nodded for Ferg to follow them. As he passed, he patted my shoulder and smiled. I called after him. Hey, you got my hat? He smiled some more.
It's on the desk.
I watched them go down the hallway, then walked over and picked up the now disreputable piece of 10X beaver felt. It needed a little work. I was dusting it off as a sharp index finger punched my stomach. It didn't go in as far as it used to. I turned to look at her. Yes, ma'am.
What are you doing out of here?
I released myself. She shook her head, but the poking stopped.
You looked like you were going to die last night.
They gave me Tylenol. I'm feeling much better. I gave her a thumbs up. What's the story on DCI? She looked at me for a moment longer.
Headed for Cheyenne with Jacob.
She looked down the hallway after George and his entourage.
What's the word on him?
I walked past the glass partition at the reception area over to the waiting room and sat back in one of the chairs. She followed along and did likewise. I looked at the soothing gray that must have been chosen, along with the muted mauve of the walls, to calm upset relatives and loved ones. It made me want to take a nap. I honestly don't think he knows anything.
What about the size 9 Vasques?
I studied my coveralls and thought about a shower and a change of clothes. I don't think it was him. It could be the guy from Casper or Jacob, or it could be somebody else. Vic studied the side of my face in the humming fluorescence.
You make it sound like somebody else.
I turned to look at her. I want to talk to Jim Keller. She raised an eyebrow.
About?
Things in general, nothing specific. She looked tired, too, but I decided to keep that to myself. You get a ballistics check on the Cheyenne Rifle of the Dead?
Yes, I did.
I had started to turn and study my dirty pants, but the tone of her voice pulled me right back around. Oh, now, why do I not like the sound of that?
No match, but it's been fired.
I was glad I was sitting down. How long ago? She inclined her head.
Difficult to say. Anywhere from 3 days to 3 weeks.
Did DCI take the rifle?
No, she smiled. Everybody's real nervous about handling that thing.
Because it's haunted?
Because it's probably worth millions.
I hadn't told her about the old Cheyenne and their assistants on the mountain.
And it's fucking haunted. She was looking at my hands. I put it in your truck and locked the doors.
Thanks a lot. I smiled at her because I liked her. Vic was like some exotic eastern bird that had accidentally landed in our high desert and had taken it upon herself to stay, and I don't know what I would have done if she hadn't. It was a profane little song she sang, but I had grown fond of it, like the first cries of the meadowlarks in the early spring. She had a quirky perspective on things and a foul mouth, but she would make a fine sheriff, no matter what anybody said or what words they used to say it. How's your love life? That caught her off guard.
Shitty, how's yours?
I shrugged and looked at the carpet. How should I know?
She was here.
I turned and looked at her with a questioning expression.
Vani.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
She crossed her arms and looked at her legs stretched out before her.
She brought flowers, but I told her you weren't dead. I don't think she thought I was funny.
Most people don't.
Most people around here got no fucking sense of humor.
She didn't move for a while.
Can I ask you a question without you getting all pissed off?
I'll try. She pursed her lips.
What is it you see in her? I mean, other than she's beautiful, intelligent, and rich. I just don't get it.
I pounded the crown back into my hat and made an attempt at straightening the brim. Relatively satisfied with the results, I placed it on my head and pulled it down. She finally spoke again.
I always wanted to be a woman like her. I think it's because she's tall.
She turned and looked at me.
It doesn't seem fair that somebody should be beautiful, intelligent, rich, and tall. That's bullshit.
I waited. How's my hat look? She considered.
Like Gabby Hayes.
I tried for another subject, the third being a charm. You been in to see Henry?
I was, but then Dina Manycamps showed up and I started feeling like a third wheel.
I moved my head back and forth like a disco dancer. He getting some sweet medicine? I put my arm around her shoulders and pulled her in. It was a risky move, but she didn't resist, and I rested my chin on the top of her head. Thanks for coming up after me. Her voice was muffled and sounded strained.
You're the only friend I've got.
I bet you say that to all the sheriffs. I held her there for a while. Her husband was an idiot. We stayed that way until I became aware of somebody looking at us through the glass partition. It was Vani. She didn't say anything, just nodded, and disappeared around the desk and down the hall where everybody else had disappeared. She was carrying a shopping bag and the aforementioned bouquet of flowers. I pulled Vic back up and looked at her. "You okay?" She smiled, but it seemed as if there was a little more ocean at the corners of her eyes.
"Yeah, I'm good."
I leaned her back and kissed her forehead. "Yep, you are." I staggered up and steadied myself on my increasingly sore legs. "Vani just walked by." She nodded.
"I'd get you into trouble?"
"I don't think we're to a place where I can get into trouble." She stood.
"That's what most guys think when they're in trouble."
She turned the corner and walked toward the automatic doors. As they opened, she paused, making them wait.
"I'll be at the office. It's getting crowded in here."
I followed Vani's trail and found her leaning against the wall outside room 62. She was holding the flowers with a shopping bag at her feet. Her long hair was pulled back in the single ponytail that she had worn to watch football with Henry and me only a few days ago. The lines in her face were more evident today in the harsh lighting, but they gave her a delicate appearance like some fragile and beautiful tapestry. Seeing her again was like unearthing an emotional library card with a lot of overdues. I slowed as I got nearer, a little worried about what might be coming. She looked up as I approached.
"Thank God you're all right."
It was good that I stopped, because those eyes were just a little bit hard. "How did you find out?" Her jaw set, and an awful lot of the wrinkles disappeared.
"I bought a police scanner at Radio Shack, thinking it would be nice to hear your voice once in a while."
We stood there for a moment and listened as a female giggled through the walls of the bear's room. "I didn't call."
"No, you didn't."
I nodded and looked at my boots. "I've been kind of busy." She stood away from the wall, the flowers clutched in her hand like a Louisville slugger.
"Did you know that they could hear you? That I could hear you? We heard every word you said, and you couldn't hear anything when they answered?"
"No."
"I could hear it all."
Her head nodded in a tense fashion.
"I could hear everything. Do you know what that's like? Hearing those words and not being able to do anything?"
She threw the flowers, and they hit me in the chest.
"I have spent my whole life getting to a place where I don't have to put up with things like this."
"I'm sorry."
"I will not let you do this to me. I will not."
She stormed past, and I raised a feeble hand to stop her. She yanked her arm away and pointed to the shopping bag on the floor.
"I thought you could use a change of clothes."
She stood there for a moment, and I thought there might be some kind of opening, but there wasn't. And she continued down the hallway as I turned and watched her go. I sighed and stooped down to pick up the flowers. As tired as I had been before, I was twice that now. I figured there were better places to take a nap, but fatigue set in and I sat down with my legs stretched out in front of me. It felt good to stretch them, and my back was starting to hurt, so I just laid back and sprawled out on the tile floor of the hallway. I placed the flowers on my chest in a fit of symbolism and closed my eyes. More giggling slipped from under the door of the bear's room. I lay there for a while, thinking that what I ought to do was get up, find a shower, and change into the clothes Vani had so thoughtfully provided. I wondered how she knew my size and thought about what she had said. I was feeling sorry for myself, and it felt pretty good. So I just lay there, musing in self-pity, thinking about life, death, and a shower, in that order. more giggling.
I had to eat something. I had to talk to the Espers and tell them about Jacob and try to confirm all of the suppositions as to what Jacob and George's plans had been, where they had been, and what had happened. My 5 minutes had run out a half an hour ago. I had to speak with Jim Keller, and it wouldn't hurt to have a word with Lonnie Littlebird about the last time the Cheyenne Rifle of the Dead had been fired.
Even more giggling.
I could also talk to the little wolf woman to see if there were any more clues as to where the feathers might have gone to and come from. I needed to follow up on the Vasks, size nines, and get a better idea on who might have been leaving tracks all over God's Little Acre in them. I didn't think it was George, but there was the disturbing habit he had of running off every time he got the chance. He had been so sure that Henry had tried to kill him on the trail that I began wondering if that might have been one of the motivations behind his constant state of flight. I also wanted to check on Henry and get a more thorough diagnosis on how he was doing. The first part was in getting my eyes to open. And when I did, an upside-down Janine Reynolds's blues were there to meet me.
"Hi, Janine."
She looked a little worried.
"I thought you might want something to eat."
"Bless you." She looked around and then back down to me.
"Are you okay?"
"Just thinking." I reached over and picked up my hat where it had fallen during my dramatic interpretation. I looked at the flowers, still clutched in my other hand. "You want some flowers?"
"No, thanks."
I pushed up and slid over to the wall as she handed a tray down to me. It was some sort of supposed egg matter that I'm sure had never seen the rear end of a chicken, and two grayish meat patties that had never oinked. I placed my hat beside me with the brim up and placed the flowers in it. I rested the tray on my lap and picked up a piece of dry toast and began chewing. No wonder so many people died here. They starved to death. Whatever this was, it was not the usual. "Janine, is there a shower around here?" She blinked. I guess it was a strange request.
"There's the one in the staff locker room."
"Would anybody mind if I used it?"
"I don't think so. You're kind of a local hero."
I continued chewing my toast and began wondering if it was real bread. "Why is that?"
"Because of what you did up there."
Everybody talked about the mountains as if they were on the second floor. I was uncomfortable with flattery, so I asked her how the Cheyenne Nation was doing. She said that he had turned out to be remarkably resilient and was lucky in that the bullet hadn't done any serious damage to any of his solid organs. While the doctors were in there, they had taken his appendix. I asked about his index, but didn't get a laugh, at least not from Janine, as a sultry giggling erupted again from room 62. We looked at each other as I continued chewing my toast, and her face reddened. "Well, it's good to know all his solid organs are functioning properly." Janine made a hasty retreat down the hallway. A few moments later, Dina Menikamps came through Henry's door. She straightened the same fringed dress I had seen her in a few days earlier and fine-tuned the lipstick at the corner of her open mouth with the tip of a middle finger. She froze for an instant when she saw me. I pulled a beaten tiger lily from my hat and held it up to her. She smiled and took it, bestowing a ravishing wink back over her shoulder as she sashayed down the hall and turned the corner. I figured that about a dime's worth of Dina Menikamps and a Fresca would kill my ass. Chapter 14.
"What do you mean he's gone?"
George Esper was once again at large. I dried off my damp hair, made sure the towel around my middle was secure, and sat beside my set of new clothes that were still in the green paper shopping bag from the sports shop. Ferg looked like he was going to die.
"He said he wanted something to eat, so I went to get a nurse."
I draped the towel from my head to over my shoulders and examined my fingers. The first layer of skin was pretty well shot, and the next was pink and sensitive. My ear hurt, and I hadn't taken the bandage off for fear of disturbing it, but mostly I felt good, being clean for the first time in a couple of days. Why didn't you just ring for a nurse?
I tried.
I thought about going back in the shower and drowning myself. Where did you see him last?
In his room about 5 minutes ago.
I handed him the portable radio, still amazingly clipped to the back of my mud-encrusted Carhartts. This building is not that big. Have somebody go stand in the northeast corner of the hospital, and you stand at the southwest. Either of you spots him leaving, call in. You use your truck radio. I looked up at Ferg and thought about how he had worked through the better part of the night, probably hadn't had anything decent to eat in days, and more than likely needed to phone his wife and let her know he was still alive. Donna worked at an insurance firm in town, and after 30 years of marriage, they were still madly in love. On Sunday afternoons, you could see them walking, holding hands, along Clear Creek in the park. He got away from me, too. Don't feel bad. I picked up my hat to keep him from feeling self-conscious. I think I need a new hat. What do you think? He looked at me with hazel eyes, not too disturbed by self-analysis, and struck out for the southwest corner of the building.
Definitely.
I sat the hat back down on the polished surface of the wooden bench, which was anchored to the floor with 3-inch pipe. I guess the administrators figured the doctors and nurses weren't making enough money and might try to run off with the furnishings. I looked in the bag at my new clothes with a sense of trepidation. If she was angry when she bought them for me, I wasn't sure if I wanted to see what size they were, but the jeans were an exact fit, as were the jacket, shirt, socks, underwear, and undershirt. After I finished dressing, I put my gun belt on, carefully adjusting the jacket so that it covered the majority of it. Then I stuffed my dirty clothes into the bag for later washing or burning, placed my hat on top, and carried it with me into the hallway. Friday, mid-morning, and there still wasn't much traffic at the hospital, which meant that George would have less cover. But even though the building was small and the staff sparse, there were probably hundreds of places where he could be. I decided to drop my clothes off in Henry's room, if he was between female visitations, and use it as a base of operations for the hunt for George Esper, take two. When I got to Henry's door, I paused to listen and hear if anybody else was in there. I heard voices, but whatever they were saying, it wasn't post-coital. So I pushed open the door and found George Esper seated in a chair beside Henry. I walked up to the bed opposite George and noticed that he'd been crying. "Did it occur to you to say something to my deputy before you went wandering off, George?" He looked sufficiently sheepish and wiped the tears on his bare arm. "I mean, before I put out an all-points bulletin and file a missing persons with the FBI."
"Sorry."
"George, here's the way it works from now on. When I put you someplace, any place, I want you to stay there until I come and get you. Do you understand that?" He nodded. "Good. Now, go back to your room." He got up and limped toward the door, but before he could get it open, I called out, "And stay there!" I listened as the door closed behind him. "I think George might be a little confused." I looked down at him. "Really? I think George is a lot confused. I am serious. I think something might be wrong with him. Other than continual flight syndrome?" Henry paused for a moment, then folded the sheet down and smoothed the edge. His hands looked strange in this setting, like wild birds accidentally indoors. "Does the family have any history of mental illness?"
"Not that I know of."
He shook his head.
"He seems scattered, and he has no attention span."
"Concussed?"
"Possibly."
He looked at the empty chair where George had sat.
"He wanted to know what he had to do if he wanted to live on the reservation. He thought he might be safer there."
"That's confused. He wasn't that bad on the mountain." We thought that one over for a moment. His eyes stayed steady on mine.
"He knows about his brother."
I felt like sitting down. "What did he say? How does he know?" He shrugged.
"It was not anything he said. It was just a feeling, but he knows."
I studied the polished railing at the side of the bed. Do you think he was with Jacob when he was killed?
I do not know that.
Henry smiled.
I am sorry to be so little help to you, but it is just a feeling. They are twins.
I leaned against the footrail and peeled a small piece of the skin from the side of my hand. How are you feeling?
Very well, and yourself?
My hands have fallen off and my ear hurts. He nodded.
Things could be worse. Your ear could fall off.
There's an intra-office pool. Odds are the doctor's going to cut it off.
That would be a shame. Your ears are one of your finest features.
I looked out the window with him. My thought exactly. They're going to get a fight when they come for it. He smiled and nodded.
Put me down to 50 on keeping the ear.
You're up against Lucian. He continued to look out the window.
He is still calling me ladies' wear.
Yep.
Make it 100.
I laughed. Well, I better call off the manhunt and go talk to George. I looked down at him again. He really was recuperating quite well and looked as though he could get up and follow me out. How's Dina Menicamps doing these days?
She is a wonderful and caring young woman.
I paused at the door. I don't suppose George mentioned what room he was in?
No.
He still looked out the window, and I wondered how long they would be able to keep him.
He was probably afraid I would come looking for him.
I watched him for a moment longer and then went out into the hall. Doctors and nurses are human, and humans are creatures of habit, so I walked across the hallway and pushed open the door of my old room. George was sitting at the side of his bed, looking out the window at the parking lot.
Hey, George. Mind if I come in?
He didn't say anything, but kept staring out the window. The snow swept across the asphalt surface, piling up wherever the concrete partitions divided the lot. Nobody wanted to be here, and everybody was looking out the windows. I pulled a chair from the wall and sat down in his line of sight. I turned my head and also looked out the window.
Well, I'm glad to be inside. How about you?
He nodded, but continued to look at the lot. I could see the bullet from here. He was probably trying to figure out how to hotwire it.
I'd say winter is here. George?
He finally turned his face toward me. I studied him carefully and noticed he was shaking. George, are you all right?
Jacob's dead.
I could feel my eyes sharpen as I looked at the young man. What makes you think that, George?
Saw him.
His lips moved, but no more words came out.
You saw him?
He nodded his head. Saw him where, George?
On the mountain.
You saw him up at Dull Knife Lake? He shook his head as violently as his bandaged jaw would allow. Where, then? The tremors continued to rack his body as his naked legs hung from the bed and shook, the nearest thigh wrapped up in a winding layer of gauze. I wasn't sure if they had him on anything, but with the head injury it was unlikely.
George, if you know anything, I need you to tell me about it. I'm trying to stop who's doing this, but I have to figure out who it is before I can do anything.
You can't stop him.
I nodded. Stop who, George?
I watched as a finger crept from his hand and pointed toward the window.
Them.
I felt a continuous charge run up my spine as I turned my head and looked out the window again, my reflected image only inches from my eyes. There was a minivan parked a little farther out, but I could almost swear that George Esper was pointing at my truck.
George, there's nothing out there but my truck.
He continued to look, but the finger disappeared into his fist. I checked again and looked out to the municipal golf course. Maybe Arnie's army was after George.
George, Who did you see up there? The only thing he said was,
"You can't stop them."
I stood up slowly and gently lowered the Venetian blinds with the cord that had been at my back. George still didn't move, so I pushed him back in the bed with a hand on his shoulder and pulled the blanket and sheet up to his chin. He still shook as if he were freezing. "Why don't you try and get some sleep?"
"You can't stop them."
I looked down at another human wreck and patted his chest. "Well, I might just surprise you." I made my way through the automatic doors of the emergency room and waved at Ferg, who joined me. We used one of the blonde brick walls as a wind block and stood against the building's entrance. "He's back in his room. I found him in Henry's, but he's back in his." The air was more than a little brisk, so I flipped the collar up on my new jacket and pushed my hands farther into the pockets. "He's acting a little strange, so you might want to keep an even closer eye on him. I don't think he's dangerous, but he might wander off again."
"You bet."
I notified them at the desk. "I'm going to head back over to the office and get things sorted out."
"You bet."
I was also willing to bet that Ferg would be sitting on George within the moment. I pulled my keys out, headed over to the bullet, and looked through the window. I'm not sure what it was I expected to see, an entire old Cheyenne war party riding shot